thanks for listening to A Little More Conversation. I'm Ben O'Hara Byrne. Tonight, we meet some solar eclipse enthusiasts. One is already packed up and ready to go this weekend, setting off to make sure she finds clear skies for the celestial phenomenon, while another is already set up in the so-called Path of Totality near Belleville, Ontario, hoping to provide a perfect view of the eclipse for all those who can't be there. We meet both of them. We are just 7 months away from the U.S. presidential election on November the 5th. And the campaign, of course, is already in full swing. Every Friday, we'll be digging into the big U.S. election stories of the week. This week, a new Wall Street Journal poll out that shows Donald Trump leading in many of the seven so-called swing states. And we find out why these stories matter as we head towards Election Day and why they matter to us here in Canada on this side of the border. The inquiry into allegations of foreign interference in the 2019 and 2021 federal elections wrapped up a very revealing week of hearings this week. Everything from politicians to political party officials, the heads of Canada's security agencies, election officials, and more gave testimony. With the Prime Minister in the hot seat next week, we look at what we've learned already and the questions that still need to be answered coming up. But first, it's been a very shaky week for the EV industry, with Tesla issuing a very gloomy earnings report and Ford announcing this week that they will delay the launch of new three-row electric vehicles to be built at their plant in Oakville, Ontario, and will adjust the timing of its next-generation electric truck as well. So what is happening? Is this just a short-term bump in the road for electric vehicles, or is this the sign of something more lasting, more enduring? We find out. Let's start tonight with some very shaky times in the EV industry. Tesla had very gloomy earnings this week, or a report of very gloomy earnings this week, that sparked a sell-off of the world's largest electric vehicle manufacturer. It sold off sharply after their earnings report showed the company was on track for its slowest quarter since 2022. The stock has fallen more than 33% this year, and that comes with, you know, around some pretty widespread skepticism about the state of the EV industry as a whole out there. Yesterday, the Ford Motor Company announced it will delay the launch of a new three-row electric vehicles that were going to be built in Oakville and adjust the timing of its next generation electric truck. Now, this is a topic that we like to go to analyst Dan Ives to talk about. He happens to be based in New York City. So just as we are arranging the interview today, all of a sudden, this quake struck. I don't know if you were reading about it today, but it wasn't a particularly big quake, about 4.8 on the magnitudes on the Richter scale. But because of where it struck, I mean, it was the talk of the town, right? He was one of tens of millions of people who got that jolt today when it hit around 10:23 a.m. local time. The U.S. Geological Survey, again, said it was a 4.8 magnitude quake. Its epicenter was near Lebanon, New Jersey. That's about 72 kilometers west of New York City. But it was felt right across the eastern seaboard from Baltimore to Boston, a rare event for the region. New Yorker Robert Cassara says he felt the rumbling.
The pictures on the walls were shaking, and I felt the rumble for about maybe 3 seconds, 4 seconds.
Yeah. Did it feel hard?
Yeah, I knew right away what it was. Yeah. It wasn't like an explosion. It wasn't people working in the building.
There you have it. It was followed by another 4.0 aftershock this afternoon that did a bit of shaking as well. There was no damage. Flights were diverted. There's infrastructure checks going on, but it was certainly the talk of the town. So when, you know, speaking with Dan Ives, an analyst at investment firm Wedbush Securities, we wanted to ask him about this quake. Dan, he joins me now. You were right there for this. What was it like, Dan?
Look, it shook for about 10 seconds, and it's definitely an interesting way to go into the weekend.
No kidding. I mean, it's not incredibly rare, but it's certainly rare enough. Did everyone sort of stop and think, what was that?
Look, I think, yeah, I mean, at first, I think everyone thought it was just their imagination. And then you realize it's actually a house shaking for 10 seconds. And it's, you know, but luckily, no wine's broken. So the weekend should be fine.
Exactly. And obviously, people were lighting up the cell phone lines and everyone was calling each other. And it felt, I mean, just because of where it happened, there's so many people there, right? That it becomes this big, big story.
Well, it becomes a huge story. And then I think on Twitter, you know, obviously that blows up. Everyone's calling each other. And, you know, getting quakes in California is one thing, New Jersey, New York, another. But I think, at least now people could wear the t-shirt. I survived the 2024 New Jersey earthquake.
Yeah, you don't live far from there, right? Isn't that right? That's close to home where the epicenter was.
30 minutes away.
Wow. Yeah, I was noticing some of you. I think we both saw the same Empire State Building tweet saying, "I'm fine," which sort of sums it all up, doesn't it?
That was a great tweet. Exactly.
Well, speaking of unsteady ground, and you've been covering this all week, Tesla's looking a little shaky these days.
I think shaky would be a compliment. Look, this has been, it's been a train wreck week because of the delivery results, the softness that they're seeing in China. And I think for Musk, it's a fork in the road time to get through this Category 5 storm.
Yeah, what is going on? Because I know, I was just in Vegas and one of our Uber drivers had a Tesla. He was sort of bragging about how awesome it was, but they're running into some serious issues here. I guess China is one of them because there's so much competition, and price is another one. We're going through an affordability crisis and the cars are still expensive. The EVs are expensive.
Well, also, there's a Game of Thrones price war going on in China. And that's been the big issue. Demand softened, competition's coming from all angles. And at the same time, the Musk antics haven't helped. So it's all kind of been a perfect storm. And look, this has been a Cinderella ride for many years, but this is definitely a white knuckle moment.
Yeah, how much does Musk? I mean, we so identify the company with the man, and he's obviously been busy with other stuff too. How much do you think that's contributing to what we're seeing here for Tesla?
I think 30% is Musk driven. I mean, look, 70% obviously is the man and what we're seeing in terms of China and the price war. But I mean, Musk has definitely not helped things. And also the communication with investors has been a horror show the last few conference calls, which is why, look, there needs to be an adult in the room. Musk needs to show that he's going to get this company through this challenging period. And that's why this is, he either gets him through it, and I believe he can, because there's massive growth, autonomous, full self-driving on the other side. But if this is a dog ate the homework excuse and he doesn't step up, it could be darker days ahead.
Yeah, tell me about those, about how investors are being treated here, because I think because Tesla has been such an important part of the EV market for so long now, it sort of felt like it couldn't fail, right? But how has he been treating those folks who've invested their money in his company?
Well, I think it's been the lack of transparency. Communication's been, really brutal. And look, when you look at Cook, Nadella, Jensen, others, they've gone through challenging periods before, but you navigate through it with shareholders, and that's not happened.
And the product itself, I understand that there's going to be some impacts of this. They're not putting out that less expensive vehicle, the one that ostensibly might be able to find new buyers in a market that's kind of squeezed for money, and obviously overseas in China. I guess that has a lot to do with it too. They're just being undercut, right?
Look, I think there's a lot of debate. I still believe a lower cost or sub $30,000 vehicle is going to come out. But right now, I mean, there's no roadmap. And investors, they don't have too much to go on. And I think that's been the frustration that we're seeing play out in the Tesla story, which is why it's been a trying time and patience is wearing thin.
You said it was a fork in the road for them. Where do they need to go then? Or where do they need to go, and where can't they go right now, do you think?
Put the roadmap out. Put the guardrails. What are price cuts going to look like? Hold margins. Give the roadmap for AI. And also commit a CEO for the next 3 to 5 years. These are all things that are important because investors, they need something to hold their hat on. And when you look at these results, and likely it's going to be soft guidance when they come out in a few weeks, it's a nerve-wracking white knuckle period.
Yeah, you called it a train wreck into a brick wall, I think is how you referred to it this week, which is pretty graphic language, really, Dan.
It's a burning train wreck into a brick wall. And I think that's, look, and that's why in the Mag 7, Tesla's on the outside looking in because of China, because of what we're seeing with softness.
Now, look, I believe the Renaissance will happen. They will get through this. But for right now, this is probably the most challenging time they've seen in the last 4 to 5 years.
Members will be laid off. The last vehicles will be coming off the line at Oakville Assembly like the first week of May, which means for our 3,200 members working at Oakville Assembly that this is the amount of downtime that they're looking at the moment.
Dan Ives is an analyst at investment firm Wedbush Securities in New York. We've been talking about the quake that hit New York today. Obviously, a big news for the millions and millions who live in that area. And, sort of some shaky times, to put it mildly, for Tesla. But Dan, we got some news from Ford this week as well. And so, I mean, a lot of companies are kind of looking at their EV plans and thinking, well, maybe we're going to go a different route. And this is a big deal. I know you've been talking about this elsewhere. This is a big deal for not just Ford, but also for Ford's operations in Canada, where a lot of this EV production was supposed to start.
The writing is on the wall, right? I mean, you've seen Ford, GM pull back from, I think some of the more aggressive EV initiatives, more toward hybrids. Look, that's what they're hearing from dealers, what they're hearing from customers. And I think you've seen some black clouds over the EV market. And this is just another one we've seen with Ford.
What's happening here? Because I think one of the things that was driving this to some extent was there was such seemed to be such a shortage of supply and big demand at a certain time a few years ago that it felt like this was about to take off. And a lot of companies such as Ford kind of jumped right in. And now it feels like that might have been a bit of an illusion, at least. What's happening, do you think?
Well, I think governments have talked a great game, but they haven't given the infrastructure. I mean, there's 110,000 charging stations in the US. You need 500,000 to get to 10% demand. So a lot of that's kind of been empty promises. Pricing's been an issue, competition, range anxiety, right? And I think it all comes down to this is going to be a big growth market over the next decade. But the view that we are going to get to 60, 70, 80% EVs, I mean, that will not happen.
Yeah. And I guess one of the big balancing act issues here for a company like Ford or others is trying to figure out how to get into this at the right speed, but not too fast and certainly not too slow.
And not alienate your customer base and your dealer network. That's the bigger issue, too. From a dealer network perspective, dealers are not doing jumping jacks for EVs.
Why is that? I mean, it did feel like there was a lot of momentum there for a little bit. You just mentioned some of the reasons. How big an issue has price been? Because again, they are expensive. I mean, in certain places in Canada, and I gather in the US as well, there are some, there are incentives in there, but they remain. If you're out there and you're already feeling squeezed by your mortgages and so on, an EV is still a pretty expensive. I mean, at least upfront, an EV is a pretty expensive proposition.
Yeah, I mean, up front, now obviously prices have come down a lot, across many of the models, but it's also about the incremental buyer. When you look, I mean, Tesla would do give or take about 2 million vehicles this year. So you have 6 million Teslas on the road. So the point is, like, you've had a lot of incremental demand, but the big thing comes down to price, and it's also an education sale.
Yeah, in that sense, I think one of the things that a lot of people are looking at is they keep reading stories about how quickly this technology is evolving and thinking, well, why would I buy one now if I'm going to get a much better, cheaper one in 3 years or 5 years?
Well, it's the death by a thousand cuts.
Right.
It goes back to, like, you remember the big screen TVs, you buy them that week later, they go on discount another 5, 10%. Okay, then you wait another week, another week, another week. And I think that's the problem that starts to happen when you go down this discounting price cut, essentially price cut war that's happening.
In the case of Canada, of course, a lot of these vehicles were meant to be built in a retooled factory in Oakville. I guess that's still going on, but Ford's definitely pulling back and reconsidering here. Do you think that'll have long-term impacts not to get into the specifics of that particular plant, but that is a big deal. That was supposed to be sort of the centerpiece for this for Ford, at least on the Canadian side of the border, and it feels like that's not going to
Look, I think
happen. And,
Ford, yeah. I think Ford's still aggressively going to go. Farley's going to aggressively go after EVs. I think it's more moderation. And investors want to see that because you don't want to see them dive into the deep end of the pool when there's questions about what's in the pool.
Yeah, and I suppose that's where the reconsideration is going. I have to worry about investors, buyers, dealers, all of it. And the timing's been hard to predict now because there has been such a sort of government push for it and so on. But reality is reality on the ground.
Look, reality is reality, and you can't smoke and mirror. And if you look at EVs a few years ago, it was a Cinderella story, and now it's, at
Now it's
least in
midnight.
some forms, it's resembling the Thriller video from Michael Jackson.
That bad? Do you think it's that bad?
It's pretty bad in the near term, and I think that's the issue.
Yeah. Well, I guess you're going to have a lot of stories to share with the friends and family this weekend about this quake then as well.
It will be great to be talking about the earthquake over wine and pizza in New Jersey.
Yeah, instead of talking about the kind of week it's been for EVs and all the things you pay close attention to.
Exactly.
Dan, as always, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's head to Ottawa now, where it's been a busy week in this foreign interference inquiry that's taking place. It was the first sort of full week of public hearings this week, I guess, with Monday being a holiday, not quite a full week, but still, the main focus, of course, of those hearings is to dig into allegations that China interfered in the 2019 and 2021 federal elections, as well as other countries as well. Foreign interference not limited to just one country. So far, Quebec Superior Court Justice Marie-Josée Hogue has heard from witnesses, including Chief Electoral Officer Stéphane Perrault, Commissioner of Canada Elections Carolyn Simard, former Conservative leader Erin O'Toole testified this week. So did Conservative Foreign Affairs critic Michael Chong, who's been on this show before, CSIS Director David Vigneault, and MP Han Dong. There were some really interesting storylines that emerged, and I'll let Stephen Chase tell us what he thought was really interesting. But here are some of the ones that stood out to me. First, Han Dong, who is a independent now, was once a Liberal MP. He resigned after the Globe reported that he had been in contact with a member of staff, I gather, at the Chinese consul in Toronto regarding the fate of the two Michaels while they were being held in China. He testified this week, and it was learned that he had sort of canvassed international students from China at this private school and that they had been bussed in to vote for him in his nomination race in 2019. So that was a bit of a dodgy one. He's asked about it. Here's what he had to say.
Why didn't you tell the commission about this earlier?
Earlier? Well, first of all, I was reminded after the interview, and to be international student, I met them, canvassed them, signed up. They showed up to vote. To me, it's pretty regular.
Pretty regular. Part of this too was that he didn't actually speak about this when he was first interviewed. It just came up in some documents the day before he testified. Erin O'Toole was also up this week, and he had some interesting things to say. Of course, he's talked quite a bit about this already, but he said on Wednesday that he's convinced meddling from the Chinese government led to the defeat of up to 9 Tory candidates during the 2021 federal election, although he doesn't believe it affected the overall outcome. Here's what he had to say.
My main concern was there were reports that verified the concerns we were hearing during the election, and nothing was shared with us at that time. We may have made some different decisions, and I do think some candidates in particularly were harmed on a personal level by some of this. And so I think that's why we need this inquiry to better prepare for elections in the future. We were not ready in 2021, and our democracy is important. So I think we have to take the measures to make it ready next time.
So those are some of the things that stood out to me this week. Of course, Globe and Mail senior parliamentary correspondent Stephen Chase was right there watching it all. Welcome. Thanks so much for your time tonight.
Oh, glad to be here.
This has been really it's been interesting from afar to try to parse what's important because it all sounds interesting. But what I've obviously found the Han Dong thing in the Liberal nomination meeting, which is not a secret. People know this happens. But that really stood out to me this week as sort of an obvious place for foreign interference to take place, sometimes with the consent of the nominee.
Yeah, I actually, one of the things that I never knew, and most people I talked to never knew, is the Liberals allow people who are not even Canadian citizens, who are not even permanent residents, who simply reside in Canada to take out memberships and to vote in nominations. And so one of the interesting, I guess consequences of that is you had Han Dong in 2019 when he was seeking the Liberal nomination in Don Valley North, a major Toronto area riding. He was actually campaigning at a private school for Chinese teenagers. And right. Then what the revelation was is, oh, I forgot to tell you guys, yeah, the school had bussed in a whole bunch of them to my nomination race. And I don't know how they voted, but I pitched them to vote. So, yeah, I'm so puzzled by that. I didn't realize that we actually, as long as you can prove you live in Canada, you can get a little membership, which is quite fascinating. But no, the Handong story was interesting. The odd thing is, one of the most interesting things is not foreign interference. It's actually him counseling the Chinese government. So it's reverse foreign interference. Right. Him, this basically CSIS, our main spy agency, taps the unsecured lines at the consulate. That's what we're deducing from this. And there was a conversation in February 2021. Where he was talking with the consul general, and you know, he's sort of hemmed and hawed about this, but a summary was produced of the conversation, not the actual transcript, but a summary which showed that he was doing some odd things. He was essentially giving the Chinese advice. He said, you know, if you did release the two Michael Spivor and Michael Kovrig, who at that time they held, most people in the world consider completely unjustified reasons, which is they were angry at Canada. They held these two men in jail. He's counseling them. He said, you know, if you did release them now, meaning February 2021, it might affirm or sort of show the benefits of a hardline approach to China. So an odd thing for a Canadian MP to be telling the Chinese government. But anyways, when he was asked about this summary that came out was tabled. He didn't remember what he said. He said he couldn't remember, which was, I think, a bad look for him. And then, of course, there was a few other things he couldn't remember. And so, no, he's a very interesting figure in this. But there are many other things going on this week. And what I have to tell people is that what's interesting to me, as a journalist who's covered this for years, but also covered a lot of the revelations last year, is that the sort of, you know, 2-month investigation that David Johnson did, the former governor general who was appointed by Trudeau to sort of do a quick in and out of this, it was absolutely inadequate, is what we're learning this week. We are learning so much more than what David Johnson purported to tell us. We're hearing about, you know, cash that CSIS is worried that was given to Chinese threat actors in Toronto. We're hearing about a real utter and complete breakdown in communications on the part of the civil service. We keep getting memo after memo where they're talking about a Chinese government or apparent Chinese government Communist Party effort to sort of basically spread a misinformation campaign against the conservatives in the 2021 election. And then we have the parties on the stand saying, nobody told us this. You know, we didn't hear this. We got nothing. So, you know, lots of revelations. We're building a real picture today. You know, also just really puzzling things are emerging today. It emerged that actually the Canadian government did take action quietly against election interference. They didn't tell anybody until today. We learned that when there was an article circulating on Facebook that came from a U.S. website called Buffalo Chronicle, an article, false allegations, completely false allegations about the Prime Minister and, you know, his experience at that school in where he taught in Vancouver. So completely false allegations. They asked Facebook, the Privy Council Office, the bureaucratic arm of the Prime Minister's office, actually stepped in to ask Facebook to remove the article, and they did. But then the commission counsel say, well, you did that. You took action in the 2019 election on that, but how come you didn't do it about WeChat and about all the misinformation circulating on Chinese language social media apps about the conservatives? And they say, well, you know, first of all, it was a really nasty attack on Mr. Trudeau's character. Trudeau. But the Mr. Trudeau's character, but the WeChat messaging, the articles there, they were more, you know, they weren't an attack on Mr. O'Toole's character. Of course, he's talking about articles that said that the conservatives were being spread among the Chinese community in Canada, that the conservatives wanted to break off relations with China, and so on. Things were absolutely untrue. But the other thing, the weird thing that came out from the Privy Council office is, well, they were in Mandarin, so it was really only something, misinformation, that would affect the Chinese community. Which is an odd thing to say.
It's precisely the point, right? I mean, we had Kenny Chiu on the show, who's a former MP in Richmond in BC. He lost in 2021, and he attributes a lot of that to the fact that there was all this information going around about the conservatives on Chinese language social media, which is precisely what you'd think they'd be watching out for. But instead, I mean, it really looks like, you know, two measures for two different parties. Here, by the way, is Aaron O'Toole. He testified this week about exactly what Stephen is talking about.
5 to 9 seats that I think were possibly changed as a result of foreign interference.
Right. That was very quick. What he'd said earlier is that they didn't know. They just didn't know. So, Stephen, I guess the portrait that's coming out here is you have a civil service or bureaucracy that either wasn't entirely aware of what was going on. And when they were, they looked like they were pretty selective with who they were telling about one or what and when they were stepping in.
And they basically didn't sound any alarms this time in the 2021 election, which is, I think, the one we're really focused on at the moment. They didn't tell anybody anything, and they sort of kept it to themselves. And now it's funny because today the Privy Council office and people in the government who are charged with this, the civil servants, they started to push back and they said, well, no, we did tell them. But we heard from all the parties, major parties this week as well, the Liberals, the NDP, and the Conservatives, the people who actually ran the campaigns, and they went on the record and said, no, we did not get explicit warnings about the Chinese government about what was going on. So it's a really interesting disconnect, and that is something which David Johnson had definitely flagged, but we're hearing it's coming out in a lot more exhaustive detail this week, the sense that there are very common traits that are happening. You've got authoritarian regimes reaching out to people who've left these countries and come to Canada and trying to pressure them, whether it's Indian, whether it's Russian, whether it's Chinese. In fact, one of the interesting takeaways from the commission, and this was the stuff we heard last week, actually, there's very common experiences being felt by people in a number of communities. Like, in some ways, I thought to myself, they should actually form some kind of group and start working together and sharing techniques and so on, because the stories are all the same.
I can understand where someone who lost an election is trying to look for reasons other than themselves why they might have lost an election. The reality is, not a single riding or the result of the overall election was impacted or changed because of foreign interference.
The Prime Minister this week, when he was asked about Aaron O'Toole testifying at this inquiry into foreign interference that's going on this week, the public hearings are, and we're hearing a familiar defense, obviously, he's going to testify. He'll be up in front of this inquiry next week. Stephen Chase is with us, senior parliamentary correspondent with the Globe and Mail, who's done a whole bunch of work on this story. In fact, in some ways, it all kind of led to what we're watching unfold this week and will again next. Interesting that that the Prime Minister continues to use that as his defense line, because I feel like we're far beyond whether it had an impact on the outcome. We just want to know what went on, right? I mean, we want to know who knew what, when, and did they do anything about it? And you're learning a lot of new stuff this week.
Yes, and just to talk about what he said there, that's actually new. He's saying not only was the overall election not affected, that is, that I wouldn't have lost even if there was no foreign interference. He's actually saying in every single one of the 338 ridings, no outcome would have been different. And that's a lot of journalists have been covering this for a long time. We're really puzzled to hear that, to see him say that, because there's no evidence for that. There's in the last two elections, where there's been a familiar trend, the liberal support has dropped generally, and the conservative support has gone up. But in about, you know, 6 to 9 ridings, conservative ridings, it went the other way. The Liberal support went up and the Conservative went down. These are ridings which have significant Chinese-Canadian populations. And the concern, of course, is that they were, many were intimidated or, in fact, lied to about the Conservative Party in order to produce that result. So what Mr. Trudeau is saying is actually a bit new, because he has right. no evidence to prove that no outcome in any of these ridings was affected.
Right. It's interesting to watch them go on the offensive here. I suppose he will be talking next week. So will his chief of staff, Katie Telford. I guess Marco Mendicino will be there as well, amongst others. What will you be looking for then when they get up to testify?
We're going to be looking for, I'm not so interested in what they have to say as the questions they're going to have to answer, because they have already, this is a second go-round. They had this last year, right, when David Johnson, the former Governor General, conducted a short and brief probe. And we also had parliamentary hearings last year. So they've been on the stand. They've got their lines down. But this time, instead of, Liberal MPs being there to sort of soften the blow, they're going to be facing difficult questioning from the opposition parties and from various groups that have been affected by this. So they're going to be on the hot seat probably for the first time. And so they're going to have to answer questions like, why, when you knew that the Chinese consulate in Toronto was targeting a Conservative MP because he criticized China because he passed a motion, helped pass a motion that recognized human rights abuses in Xinjiang as genocide, why didn't you tell him? Why did it take right. 2 years in the Globe and Mail reporting before you finally kicked out the diplomat, Zhou Wei, which they did last May? They've never explained why nobody who has sent that report did anything. And they're going to have to explain why there were so many warnings during the election that were not passed on even to the parties. Why they have, not even moved ahead with a foreign interference registry, which would actually require people who are working on behalf of foreign governments to register, like they have to in Australia and the United States, and now the United Kingdom as well. So they're going to face a lot of difficult questions, and it'll be interesting to see, because normally in parliamentary hearings, you get the Liberal Party, the Liberal MPs intervening to sort of help them throw them softballs, disrupt the testimony, and so on. But this time, there's going to be a lot less friendly questions.
Yeah, and oftentimes the opposition MPs are kind of there for their own social media accounts. And the question's not that they're terrible, but they could often be overly aggressive and they just kind of lose their point. Whereas if you get a lot of pointed questions in an inquiry setting, and we saw it with Han Dong, we've seen it this week already. There were a few uncomfortable pauses this week in the testimony.
It was awkward for him, yes, definitely. I'm not so sure he's going to be allowed back into the Liberal caucus.
Yeah, it's been interesting too, just what you were talking about, because I think a lot of people, when David Johnston left as the special rapporteur and was sort of seen as a political witch hunt, at least that's what the Liberal accusation was. But you're learning this week that in fact, whatever it was that his mandate was or what his conclusions were, seem now that you're getting to see some of this evidence that he would have seen, I gather, that in fact this was
way more.
The inquiry was definitely needed. The sunlight was needed, and it was not happening this time last year.
No, we're hearing about, hundreds of thousands of dollars that intelligence agencies worried was being dispersed by the Chinese consulate. We're hearing about, details of intelligence and evidence gathering that we were never party to, with a sort of, one little tiny slim booklet that David Johnston put together. Of course, one of the people who've been entrusted to do a review of the 2021 election was the former president of the Pierre Elliott Trudeau Foundation. So, there's a lot of questions about whether we were getting the full story and whether it was being the investigations and the sort of checking that was done was being done on a full, transparent, and open basis. And now it's clear why we needed the inquiry, because I think, and this week proved it.
Yeah. I asked your esteemed colleague, Bob Fyfe, this question a little while back. Are you more confident now that this is underway, that we might get some of the answers that you in particular, you and your team at the Globe and Mail in Ottawa have been looking for?
There are, I have a lot of, I think there's a lot of problems with the inquiry at the same time. They have an artificial deadline of that they have to produce a report, first report, by May. And then they have the way it's set up, it's broken into two. The first report has to be issued early on the last two elections, and the second stage of the inquiry is going to look at changes that need to be made, and that doesn't have to come until December. But there was a false urgency that we needed to have a report done by May because maybe we might have an election. It's clear we're not going to have an election anytime soon. So I wish that Justice Hogue would take her time and take a more in-depth look at things. I feel there's a bit of an undue haste here that based on the mandate that was given last fall.
Right. Well, Stephen, look forward to seeing your reporting next week. Have a great weekend. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Really doesn't feel like it was that long ago that there was a U.S. presidential election featuring Joe Biden and Donald Trump back in 2020. Here we are, 2024, 7 months from today, they'll be counting the ballots once again. Of course, it will be the same two people fighting to take up residence. Well, one will want to stay in the White House, the other is trying to get back in. Interestingly enough, many Americans polled really didn't want to see a rematch between these two men for president, but that's what they've got. The poll suggested is still very much up for grabs. New numbers this week in a Wall Street Journal poll show a slight advantage for Mr. Trump, or Donald Trump, I should say, in six of the seven battleground states, but none does he win a majority. So it's Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, North Carolina, and Pennsylvania. They're tied in Wisconsin. As I was mentioning, Joe Biden is struggling with some anger over the economy, which is bizarre because the economy in America is doing well. Here is Wall Street Journal's editor, Aaron Zittman.
In these seven swing states, voters are more focused on the economy and more sour over the economy than our voters nationwide. And that's a problem for Joe Biden. The economy is strong by traditional measures, but people aren't giving the president credit for it. And that's something he's going to need to address.
Well, no kidding, because normally if the economy is roaring, incumbents do really well. That's not really the case here. Jeremy Kinsman is with me. He's a longtime diplomat, distinguished fellow of the Canadian International Council. He's been writing about this, including today. I believe the article was called "It's Not the Economy, Stupid." Jeremy, thanks for your time tonight.
Hi.
Interesting to see where we're at. Here we are 7 months out. Joe Biden was visiting that bridge collapse in Baltimore today. And it's interesting because the economy, as you pointed out, is doing well in America. Jobs numbers out today look good. And yet the overriding perception is that the economy is not doing great and Biden's paying the price for it.
Well, it's not the overriding perception. It's the overriding perception on the part of Republicans. And I think it's because the population politically is so polarized that Republicans just can't bring themselves to give Biden credit for anything. In fact, it's the best economy in terms of national numbers in 50 years. It's quite extraordinary, and across the board, by the way. But consumers don't feel it.
Yeah.
And part of the thing, Ben, is a hangover psychologically from COVID, and it's memory. I still remember you can get a hamburger for 20 cents. I mean, it's, and I'm paying 20 bucks. There's a lot of generalized resentment out there, a lot of angst, a lot of grievance among the population, distrust of institutions and stuff. It's a very odd time. It's a very important election. And I don't think that it's ever been more difficult to find out what people are really thinking,
Yeah. Yeah, I was just in the States, and much like here, it's right when they look at the numbers, the traditional stats, the economy is doing great, but people talk about the price of food going up. People talk about restaurant meals being too expensive, mortgages being too high. I mean, they have the same gripes that people here have, and you sort of have this overall sense of discontent.
Yeah, well, that's true. But the American economy is booming. I mean, anybody else in the G7 would, kill to get the GDP growth that America's putting out. At 15 years ago, 20 years ago, we look at the top 10 corporations in the world. Only, three or four were American. Today, 9 of 10 are,
Yeah.
And the stock market today is, again, breaking records. It's largely driven to some extent by tech, by big tech, but not only. America's doing well. It's creating jobs. It's creating working jobs. It's not that when I say working jobs, I'm talking about, plant jobs. And not necessarily white collar jobs and service jobs. And so it's really doing well. There is something psychological here because 55% of Americans say their personal circumstances have been improved, but they won't extend that to the economy in general. There's suspicion of it. And I, you know, I'll be candid with you. I think that the polls will change. They could change. I mean, may not, but they probably will. We're still, 7 months out, as you said, and Americans don't really, bear down on the election until Labor Day. But what won't change is the poll about apprehension about Biden's age. Mm-hmm. He's not going to get younger, despite that nice cute ad he's got out there. And and despite a great performance with the State of the Union speech, he spoke for an hour. He was really, really out there, boffo, But it's people are apprehensive. They ask, what's he going to be like when he's 86 and he's still president if he wins? And so there's a reluctance to say this guy did that. I don't know. So there you are. There are two different, communications universes in the United States. And people, listen to the channel that pleases them, and they don't always get the straight talk about reality on either side, So it's very hard to judge.
And you get the impression that if his rival in this wasn't so flawed himself, didn't have sort of disapproval numbers that are really high as well. In fact, you pointed this out in your article that you wrote today. A lot of people didn't want to see these two men again. They didn't want to see this battle again. Now they've got it. And you get the feeling that a lot of people don't like either of them.
Well, yeah, it's absolutely true. There's a new category of voter. They're called double haters, It turns out there's an 8%. Biden has an 8%. Advantage, and that 8% less people hate him as much as they hate the other guy. But you're quite right. These are the two that presumably they're going to get. There's still a very strong, anticipation or expectation on the part of a lot of seasoned observers that ballot in November is not going to be necessarily these two guys. Right. And it could be an act of God, or something could happen. It's very hard to say. People are uneasy and apprehensive. And the world is too, of course.
Well, indeed. I mean, therein lies the issue. We're all sort of sitting here watching and thinking, this is a very bizarre looking election going into it. And you think, I was just in the States. I asked someone, what's going to happen in November? He's like, don't ask.
That's true.
When you look at some of the wild cards here, of which there are many, clearly Donald Trump's legal troubles, I don't think that's necessarily going to happen, but it has to. Who knows, right? And then, of course, the age thing is interesting because, Donald Trump's not exactly young either. I wonder if they all just sort of, they all cancel each other out at some point.
I guess they do. He seems more energetic. He's 4 years younger. Joe Biden, it's unfortunate. He has a kind of a neuropathy in his feet that make him take those little steps, And so he looks, he's walking kind of tippy toe that he looks maybe older than he actually is. But performance is everything in American elections. It's a performative art form, And so it is what it is. But, and we also kind of project our own jobs onto what the president does, that everything the United States is doing, that guy's doing. Of course, he's not.
He's
and
not.
He does have, this is a terrific team he has around him. And I hope, for his sake, I hope that he's able to get that out there. It's not just about him. But he's got problems in his party. He's got, problems over his very great reticence to criticize Israel too much, that has lost a lot of younger voters that would have come out for him. Maybe they're too young to have remembered what Israel's all about in some respects, but they're also much more humanitarian in some of their impulses than older folks, And so we'll see what he does. He may come off with, a statesman's success in solving this, tragic situation on both sides in between Israel and Palestine. So we'll just have to see. It is 7 months. They say a week is a lifetime in politics. Well, 7 months is an eternity. So
it is,
we'll
indeed
see what happens.
It keeps a lot of the public from considering people like me that have much, I have a much higher popularity rating than either of these candidates. So more people would rather see me in office than, presumably, than either of them. But they are not going to vote for me because the, you know, the media and this whole sort of cartel from both sides is telling them, oh, you have to choose between these two guys. The other guy is so scary.
The other guy is scary. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. speaking with Chris Cuomo last night. Jeremy Kinsman is with us this half hour. He's a distinguished fellow of the Canadian International Council, a longtime Canadian diplomat. He's just written something about the U.S. election, and we're talking about the U.S. election. 7 months from tonight, they'll be counting the votes. We probably won't know 7 months from tonight who's won. We'll see. We'll see. Jeremy, interesting. I mean, third-party candidates is always one of those topics that people talk about with 7 months to go, right? But the RFK thing is kind of an interesting thing because in some senses, although I'm not sure about the cabal that he refers to, in some senses, he is more popular than the other two guys, in some senses.
Well, yes and no. I mean, yeah. Most people don't know him. There was a poll about 2 months ago which said a significant portion of the people who like him actually think he is his father. You know, so let's not take this candidacy too far. I think right now he's polling around between 8 and 9%. Some of that is that people are confused as to what he is. On some things, he's on the right, and other things, he's on the left. As you know, he's a very, very big vaccine denier, and that's got a certain market out there. But it's also made his family dissociate themselves from his candidacy, and they feel acutely unhappy that he's. His name is what it is. And his dad is who he was, but his dad was a hero for many people. So anyway, I don't know. It's very hard to really get a complete fix on which of the two candidates he draws votes from most. I just don't know. The American system abhors third-party candidacies. The only one that's made any difference in our lifetimes has been Ross Perot, of course, who took, I think about... He took enough 17 or 18% in 1992, and that enabled Bill Clinton to sneak through over George H.W. Bush with only 43% of the vote. But other than that, you know, it's hard to say. Ralph Nader took maybe 3% in 2000, but he took thousands and thousands of votes in Florida, which of course George Bush W. Bush won by only 351 or something.
Yeah, at a hanging chad.
Yeah, that's right, a hanging chad. So they can screw things up. There's no question about that. So we'll just have to see. I noticed that there was a move, and you noticed too, of course, to actually have a genuine third party out there called the No Labels Party. But they couldn't talk anybody into running on the ticket. And so they withdrew the thing after actually spending quite a lot of money. Just this last week. So in the end, it's going to be the same polarized people scape that we've grown to shudder at in the United States. You know, Ben, democracy works at the center. I mean, I hate to give that news to people who really think they've got the whole truth and nothing but the truth on one of the extremes. But that's not where compromise happens. And compromise is what makes a democracy work. And that's the problem right now, and I'm apprehensive to some extent because Trump is not in any way trying to woo Nikki Haley's voters. You know, she got 25%, 30%, 35% in the primaries. Yes, he won by 50%, 40%, 45%, but that's a lot of people she got, and a good portion of them are saying they won't vote for him. I don't know why he's not pitching himself to them. But he refuses to. He says, they're all Democrats anyway. Well, they're not all Democrats. This thing is, you know, hanging by margins. Today, the polls show Biden creeping up again. Okay, yeah. A couple of polls had him ahead. One has him tied. It doesn't really mean anything in that system of theirs with their electoral college, you know. And so popular vote, which he won by several million last time, the actual electoral college vote was of course very close, which is why there was all the brouhaha that we knew. So it's gonna come, a really tough one,
seven
and,
states,
and the world's
right?
biting its nails.
Indeed. It's going to come down to the same seven states, they think, more or less, right? I mean, there's been some talk Nebraska losing the site, but
The election cost $16 billion last time, and it really came down to being about 100,000 votes. And you divide that 100,000 into $16 billion, and you're talking $125,000 a person there that people are really fighting for. So it's an odd system, but it is the anchor country for democracy, and everybody who is a Democrat is hoping it doesn't get screwed up.
Indeed. Jeremy, it's always a pleasure. Thanks so much for taking the time on a Friday night. I appreciate it.
You bet, Ben. Nice to talk to you.
Staring at the sun, there'll be a lot of people staring at the sun with their protective eyewear on, of course, on Monday afternoon when that total solar eclipse sort of sweeps across a nice chunk of North America from southern Mexico right through America into eastern Canada, mostly right through kind of southern Ontario and then right up the 401 past places such as Belleville and Kingston and Cornwall into Montreal, Sherbrooke, and then into the Maritimes and so on. So lots of people getting very excited about this over the weekend because people will be on the move, of course. Niagara is expecting hundreds of thousands of people, Belleville as well. It is, of course, once in a lifetime event, and that is true for those unwilling to go very far to see one, by the way, because they aren't really that rare. They happen about every 18 months or so. It's what's rare here is where it's happening, where so many people can just step out their door and have a look. So, you know, for those who are really preparing, it's become something of an obsession to make sure they get the right place and they're ready to go, from testing their gear to monitoring the weather, charting a route to find the clearest skies, making that move on Sunday so they're in place on Monday. My next guest witnessed her first eclipse back in 1979, saw another total eclipse in Aruba in 1998. She's traveled to witness other celestial events over the years as well. Andrea Gironis is definitely over the moon about what's going to happen on Monday. So Ottawa is where she is. They'll see about a 98.9% totality just before 3:30 p.m. local time. But in her case, she wants to see the whole thing. So that means moving. So there are lots of places she can go. To the west, there's Belleville and Kingston and Brockville. To the east, there's Cornwall, Montreal, Sherbrooke, and into New Brunswick. And she's willing to go a long way with her cameras and her equipment and all the stuff that she has. She's a lawyer, but her hobby is astrophotography, she'll explain. And she's getting set to bolt on Sunday, so we thought we'd catch up with her tonight. Andrea Gironis is a counselor with Ottawa's chapter of the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada. She joins me now. Andrea, thank you so much.
Well, thanks for having me.
Everyone's getting very excited about this. I know that there are people out there who've seen a total solar eclipse. You've seen two of them. What is the difference then between a lesser solar eclipse, if there is such a thing, and a total one?
Well, it's very common to have a partial eclipse, and that's basically the yellow disk of the sun is somewhat covered by the moon. And they happen pretty regularly. And anytime you have a partial eclipse, you need to be always have your eyes protected and your cameras protected because the sun is very dangerous. Now, a total eclipse is when the entirety of the moon covers the entirety of the solar disk.
Right.
And it's this remarkable coincidence of geometry, right? That the moon is in the right distance from the Earth to make a perfect circle and perfectly block the bright sun. And so what happens when the bright sun is covered? Not only is it safe for a human to look at the sun, which we never can do, it also exposes what's known as the corona,
right,
which is the white, gassy surrounding, it's like a crown. It's a circle. It's a white glow all around the sun. And you never, ever would be able to lay eyes on that without a total solar eclipse.
I suppose what I was getting at is just the sensation of seeing it, because I've seen partial eclipses and they're impressive. I've never seen a total eclipse. I understand that it's legions different. It's that much more impressive, as you've been pointing out, for the reasons you've been discussing.
Well, it is very exciting. I do remember that. And I do like to take photos, and I'm always trying to practice, because you get so excited when you see it. You're like, oh, you can't breathe, you can't think. Yeah, it's very exciting. It's very strange. It's very beautiful. The light is unique and different. Yeah, and it's just so rare, and it feels so special. And you feel very lucky to be in the right place at the right time.
And you only get a few minutes, right? I mean, honestly, totality only lasts briefly. So there's a lot of anticipation as the sort of, as you see it begin to cover up. And then all of a sudden, the totality is quite quick. So you really need to be on your toes.
You have to sort of try to remember why you're there, which is take a picture of it. And the other side of it is you also don't want to be staring at your camera the whole time and forget to look. So there's a fine balance that we strive to strike.
You've been at a couple, I believe, Timmins in 1979 with your dad, and then Aruba again in 1998. So you've seen a few. I'm wondering what it's like to be in the crowd, too, just the reaction of people, because I think we're all so focused on what's happening celestially that we forget what's happening down on Earth. And it can be pretty amazing, too, just the reaction of the people around you.
Yeah, it is. Everybody reacts differently. People are all very excited. It's a communal feeling of being with other people with the same interests, and everybody gets quite excited. This eclipse is unique because it crosses over land, over all of North America. So many people, weather permitting, will have an opportunity to experience that.
Yeah. And again, this time, no need to go all the way to Aruba or even Timmins. It's literally coming, nearly coming to you.
Yes.
That being said, there are, you know, weather factors at play that will make for either a perfect day or a less than perfect day. And I gather you've been trying to figure out what exactly that's going to look like on Monday afternoon.
I think everybody does. And most of the weather forecasting models and websites, they actually have an eclipse forecast just for people like us. It makes or breaks it. I mean, you can still experience the eclipse with a light cloud or a haze or scattered clouds, but like a thunderstorm, you're not going to see anything.
No, I suppose in that sense, this is almost such a golden opportunity that you have a pretty wide patch you can cover from where you are, though, in Ottawa. You can get west and east pretty quickly if need be. So have you determined a range as to what you might be looking for come Monday morning?
Well, Monday morning is too late. This is Sunday. I have to move.
Okay.
And for me, the range was always going to be southwestern Ontario, where I do have family, or heading towards Quebec and New Brunswick.
Yeah, that's a big patch.
Well, I'm hoping I don't have to go to New Brunswick. I really don't want to go there. You know, it's not bad near Kingston and in the Ottawa area. There might be some light haze, but there might not be. So likely the further east that I go, it'll be more stable, more certain. You want certainty because you bring a lot of equipment and you want to set up. If you're just looking with your glasses, you can drive anywhere.
So are you all packed? I mean, back in my reporter days, I always had a bag, you know, in my foreign correspondent days, I always had a bag pack because you never knew when you were going to go. So you must be set and ready to roll on Sunday.
I had my one telescope all packed up, but then I wanted to test something. So I've just unpacked it all. I'm running another test. Then I'm going to pack it again.
It almost sounds stressful to some.
I'm very stressed. I'm extremely stressed.
Really?
Yeah, no, it is. It's like the big show. It's, you know, you want to be ready for the moment. And I guess it's like a performance. You know, you want to practice. If you're going on to a skating performance, you would practice. And so you're ready for the big day. So that's the way I'm trying to look at it.
Yeah, come prepared, as the Boy Scouts would say.
You don't want to have to think too much. You want to be on autopilot because you will get very excited and it'll be fun.
Indeed. I suppose for all those who haven't seen it, there really is no excuse to miss it. Because for many, if they're not willing to pack up and go to somewhere like Aruba or go follow, chase the eclipse, as they're called, or eclipse chasers, this one is landing right on the doorstep of so many people. It would seem a real shame to miss it.
Well, I would hope, you know, workplaces let people step outside, go outside. I know places like Queen's University got glasses for everybody. I know the province of Nova Scotia got them for all the children out there. So, you know, hopefully as many people as possible can see it.
And if not this one, do you know when the next one you would go look at might be? I realize you're not exactly someone who sort of packs up everything every time there's a one that goes over land.
No.
But clearly you must have an eye on where the next one might be in case this one turns out to be a bit cloudy.
I think the next one might be going through Europe and Spain, but I actually have my eye on one 4 years out in Australia.
Aha, the other side of the world.
Yeah, because they have a whole different sky to do astronomy for, and it would be an excuse to go to the Southern Hemisphere and do astronomy there.
Well, you've got me excited about it. I'll have to watch it online from where I am here, way out west. We're not getting much of a, getting a little bit of one. It's supposed to be cloudy as well. Fingers crossed for good weather, and we'll be watching for where you wind up on Monday afternoon. Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you, and good luck to everybody.
I want to get blinded by the light on Monday. Of course, we're talking eclipse this half hour. We just met Andrea Gironas, who's packed up, ready to go, still testing her telescope out to make sure it's going to work. She has her cameras all set. She's going to hit the road on Sunday to make sure she gets to a nice clear spot in time for totality, or at least in time for the entire show, which starts sort of early afternoon and lasts right through to mid-afternoon on Monday, with totality lasting just a few minutes. For all of us who aren't anywhere near where totality is going to happen, or are in a place where it is cloudy, or just can't get out, or don't have the proper gear to watch and so on, there are alternatives. Yesterday, we told you about a live stream at Niagara Falls. The community of Niagara Falls is doing that. You can find it on their website. And just a few hundred kilometers from there in the Bay of Quinte, actually maybe not that far, on the shores of Lake Ontario, a veteran TV crew is also setting up shop to bring us the eclipse from beginning to end, including those few minutes of totality there in Belleville between 3:22 and 3:24 p.m. local time. They're setting up multiple cameras, even a drone. The full solar eclipse, again, is set to take place between 2:08 and 4:33. So they're going to do the whole kit and caboodle, including the totality. And Scott Granville, veteran TV producer and writer, he will host and produce this show called Totality on the Bay, which you can watch on YouTube for all those of us who can't actually witness it in person. And he joins me now from Belleville. Scott, thanks.
I appreciate the time, Ben. It's been awesome.
Tell me about the prep going into this. How long have you been sort of preparing and setting up for this? We knew the day was coming, right? We knew that Belleville and that area was going to be right in the path of totality. So, wow, what an occasion.
Yeah, it has been the last 3 or 4 weeks has been building up. It's quite exciting. We've been doing this for just 4 weeks. It's not really that long to get prepared for this, but we have our own remote TV van. It's an old NBC news van that we've converted, and basically it looks exactly like you would expect a 1980s TV news van to look like.
Oh yeah. I spent some time in those.
We're going to be able to have a 5-camera shoot on the Bay of Quinte, which is in Belleville, Ontario, the beautiful city of Belleville. And we get to showcase this great city during this amazing event. And boy, oh boy, it's going to be awesome, because they're predicting huge crowds everywhere in Niagara, Kingston, and of course, in Belleville too, Ben.
Yeah, amazing. Tell me about just getting set up, because shooting an eclipse, I would imagine a lot has to go into actually trying to figure out how to shoot an eclipse, because a celestial phenomenon by its very nature is going to mess with your cameras, right?
Absolutely. And we have special cameras and filters used to get the best point of view for people that are watching. See, we're doing this live on YouTube and streaming it live in order for people to stay safe. We're trying to encourage people, because there's going to be huge crowds, that's obvious, but we want people to stay safe. And we think that if you stay at home and watch it on YouTube on Totality on the Bay, you'll be able to get amazing viewpoints. So we have the Nikon P1000 is an amazing camera that we're going to be using to get shots of the sun. We also have a 40-foot mast on our TV truck that we're going to be launching our camera from. So that'll be our second point of view. We got one that's got a wide shot of the crowd, because we expect to be interacting with the crowd. You know, the old city TV, Much Music days. I used to work there, and that's what it feel like, I believe, because there's so much momentum building. The people at the city of Belleville don't even know what's going to hit them, I think, because it's really exciting. And yeah, it's been fun. It's a 3-hour broadcast, no script, but we've got a great show lineup. We've got teachers coming in to teach a little bit. So it'll be a teaching moment. It'll be a fun moment. And there's going to be a lot of awe-inspiring, because at 3:21 Eastern Standard Time, that's when totality will happen on the Bay of Quinte. It's going to be exciting.
Yeah, you might want to bring out the speaker's corner to get people to react to it after, if you still have one lying around. But in this case, one of the things that's interesting too, I hear this from people who witnessed these, because I've never seen a total eclipse. I'll have to watch it. I'll have to watch your totality on the bay because I'm out in Victoria where we're going to get nowhere near that. Is that not only is it interesting to look up, provided you have the proper protection, but also to look around you because the reaction of people, the way that nature reacts, the sudden darkness, it's a really interesting phenomenon in and around your sort of surroundings as well as above.
Well, I've been lucky enough to see one when I was 8 years old in 1972. It shows me my age in Charlottetown, PEI. But I don't remember a lot of it, so I'm really excited to see the word that I've been associated with that particular time during totality is awe. Everyone is in awe of what's happening, and I can't wait because it is going to be interesting. Our cameras are going to be picking it up, and people are going to be able to see it because, yes, you're right. As soon as totality happens, which is 3:21 in local Belleville time, for those 2 minutes, the skies go so quickly dark. And then, yeah, the weather changes. The reaction of the animals and the birds is going to be very interesting. And we're going to be able to pick that up great. And we're really looking forward to bringing it to viewers. So, yeah, it's an exciting time. It's been building, as you said, it's been a few weeks. A slow build, but boy, oh boy, Monday's coming along real quick.
I hope you've set this up in a way that you will be able to sort of get a chance to stop and look yourself too, because you wouldn't want to. I've talked to lots of people who, and everyone's like, "Oh, I'm going to be working," and you think, "Well, you need to take just a moment." And you've seen one already, so maybe not a once in a lifetime experience, but I suspect you're going to at least take a second to put on your protective glasses and look up.
Oh, for sure. Absolutely. Because, I mean, this is what we've all been waiting for. And just 2 minutes, that's enough time for me to stop. And, you know, we're on, like I said, this is a 3-hour broadcast. I don't think I'm going to be needing to talk too much during those 2 minutes. It's just going to be something that we can sit by, listen to what the animals are doing, listen to the sky, and watch the people.
And the crowd. I understand people sort of cheer and celebrate. I mean, it feels like it's sort of primeval, right?
Absolutely. And yeah, it's going to be exciting. And again, because we have so many cameras there from different points of view, it's going to be interesting to see. And it's 2 minutes, but it's going to feel a lot longer than that, I believe.
Yeah, or it might just fly right by. So for people who would like, obviously, not just for people who would want to stay safe and maybe avoid the crowds in and where you are, for those elsewhere who will not be getting to see a total eclipse, how do they find you on Monday?
You can go to YouTube, and it's youtube.com/@totalityonthebay. And right. You can subscribe to get a notification before the broadcast, or you can just watch live. We're starting at 1:30 till 4:30, and it's just we're going to have a lot of guests talking about the eclipse, talking about Belleville, and getting people excited. Entertainment, you name it, we're going to have it there. It is going to be awesome on the Bay of Quinte in Belleville, Ontario. Can't
right.
wait.
Scott, thank you.
I appreciate the time, Ben. It's been awesome.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his 6-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his 2-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone. Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.